Paradigm shifters, you might be one and I might be one, but really I'm interviewing people who are making a difference in the collective at this time, the time of the great shift we keep hearing about. What is this great shift? Maybe we're getting wiser. We're certainly getting to be more authentic, more willing, ready, willing, and able to create our reality on an individual and a collective level. And who's inducing that kind of wisdom? Well, my name is Veronica Entwistle, and I'm presenting to you today Don Goey of a wonderful book called Mystic Cool, in which he talks about stress and about what it does to your brain and what you can do about it in order to become more authentically yourself and more empowered. So welcome to the show, Don.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
Yeah, I'm really glad that you came back. We just got going last time, and we didn't finish it all because it never gets finished anyway, does it?
No, it never does.
So I know we've already talked to you and about this, but I still think you should recap what it took you to awaken to a lot of the wisdom that's in this book, Mystic Cool, which is a great book, incidentally. A lot of the last listeners bought it and have phoned me about it and discussed it and all that.
Ah, oh, great. It's great to hear. Well, it took a perfect storm of stress to wake me up to the truth that stress was fear and that peace is power. Peace is power at every level that matters to a life, every level that can help a life shift from great difficulty to success, to moving forward. I was working in a high-powered job at Stanford University, working really hard. It was a stressful job. I wasn't getting along with my chairman of the department there. And
you were in the financial world, weren't you, there?
Yeah. No, well, I was an executive, and mm-hmm. I was running the Department of Medicine, second only to the chairman of the department. So I was handling all the managerial things.
Oh, wow.
Of this vast department. It was actually the biggest department in the whole university.
Wow. So you're kind of like a brain in your job.
Yes, exactly. I was the neocortex. But, you know, one week actually, my whole world came crashing down on me. The beginning of the week, I was notified by the chairman that I was fired, that he wanted to get somebody that was more in alignment with his strategic values. And at the end of the week, I was diagnosed with a brain tumor.
Oh, wow. And you had four kids, didn't you? Four kids?
I had four kids, a big mortgage, a marriage that was struggling because, you know, I was away so much, working so hard on this job, trying to make it work. And when all of that came down, the pressure, the fear, the stress, it was just widening the cracks in an already difficult relationship, a difficult marriage. So I felt lost. I'd wake up in the middle of the night, try to adjust to these circumstances, and I would stare out into the dark, and I've never been more fearful or stressed or felt more alone.
And how did your brain tumor feel? Did it feel painful? Or
what happened was, the way it got signaled was that I put a phone receiver to my ear, and when I was answering the phone, I couldn't hear anything.
Uh-huh.
I was deaf in that ear. And so they put me through a series of tests, and one thing led to another, and they found this very large tumor where all the cranial nerves come together. And so what they were predicting is it needed surgery, and they predicted that I was going to need a walker because it was going to affect the balance nerve. That they predicted that my face would be half frozen, drool a lot, and that I was never getting any of the hearing back that I lost. Pretty disabled picture. And then, you know, they warned me too that any time you go into the brain and do any kind of surgery, there's always a risk of creating some problem just by virtue of being in there, in that delicate brain of ours. Mm-hmm. And I just didn't see how I was going to be able to re-enter the job market with a level of disability like that, particularly being an executive who had recently been fired. And then I had this awakening. A kind of epiphany that happened to me in the middle of it all. You want to hear about that?
I really do, yes. I've already heard it, but I want to hear it again.
You want to hear it again?
I really do. It's very inspiring.
Well, I was as frightened and darkened and felt as hopeless as I've ever felt. And one evening, my wife and I, you know, had words with each other, said some very discouraging things to one another, and I stomped away. I went out to the patio and just to get away from it all. And my mind just began to think all of these catastrophic thoughts of, I was doomed. My family was headed for the poorhouse. I wasn't going to be able to even save my marriage. I was alone. It was over. And
you were 38, is that right?
I was 38 at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And each one of those thoughts magnified with fear. And then the next one magnified together. And it just got to this point of abject terror, and began to spiral down into this dark chasm that didn't seem to have any bottom to it. It was terrifying. And I did everything that I could think of to arrest this psychological fall, but nothing helped. Mm-hmm. Nothing helped. I was in a level of fear that there was no coming back from.
I can imagine.
And mm-hmm. suddenly I just sort of, everything went blank. I seemed to disappear into nothing. And then there was this experience of me coming back. And that experience of coming back was, I was calm. There was something more vibrant about me. I had this feeling of being loved by something or someone. I couldn't identify it, but I sure could feel the feeling. Something was loving me. Something was close to my heart. And the more I gave in to this feeling of calm and this feeling of love, the larger it became. In the same way that that fear had been magnified, as I gave in to these feelings, they became magnified. And I finally reached this point where I was really at peace, and it was wonderful. And it was, I realized it was everything I wanted in my life. Everything that I'd been pursuing in my life, whether it was money, love, health, whatever it might have been, it was always for this experience, to be at peace with myself, with my life.
So this is like a near-death experience, really, isn't it?
In a way, yeah. I think it was kind of a psychological death, and one I needed to die, that fearful, hopeless, pessimistic mind of mine. It needed to die, or I was going to. And so I wasn't going to go back to work. You know, when I came out of that experience, I sort of looked around and did a reality check. Am I still, you know, fired? And yes. Am I still got a brain tumor that needs surgery? Yes. Is my wife still angry with me? Oh, yes, she's still angry. And it all was that way, but I had this feeling that I was fine and that if I could just be at peace, I could deal with all of that, and I could deal with it in a way that would turn it and move it in a forward motion instead of spiraling down into hopelessness. And I wasn't going to go back to work after having been fired. You know, since I was a top executive, I got this big golden parachute thing. But I wanted to go back. My heart wanted to go back and finish some things up and leave in a good way and mend some relationships, some people that I'd blamed for my demise. I wanted to patch things up and leave the place in a good way. And when I went back, an amazing thing happened is all the things that used to stress me in that job, and it was a pressure cooker, they didn't stress me anymore because of my attitude, my dynamic state of peace is the way I would call it. I looked at some of these people that I thought had undermined me and stabbed me in the back, and I could see that it was just as likely that I just misperceived the whole situation.
Oh, interesting.
And there was the only thing, and I also realized that the one thing that would preserve my peace of mind was to forgive them and forgive myself and forgive the whole world for misperceiving everything it always misperceives anyway. I showed up for the brain surgery about 3 weeks later, in a very good place, and went through that surgery, and everything turned out to the positive. I even got my job back. I had none of the disabilities from the surgery. The dean or the people in the medical school, I think they saw. I think it was a bit of a surprise to people. You know, usually somebody gets fired, they're pretty bitter and you know, pointing fingers and that
reactive,
sort of thing. And
yeah.
And here's this peaceful guy being very positive and forgiving and working on things to finish them up. And I think the people in the medical school said, we don't want to lose this guy from our team. And they found me another job just as good. Actually, in the Department of Psychiatry, with working with people that were a better match for me, actually. And things didn't work out with my wife. We divorced, but it was for the best. Mm-hmm. It ended up for the best. She ended up marrying a really wonderful guy, and we raised the kids together.
Oh, wow.
And the one thing I discovered, you know, through that whole process and never forgot, was that all that stress I was in, it wasn't happening to me, it was happening in me. It was related to the level of fear that I was allowing. And then I discovered, too, that peace isn't just some word that you get at Christmas on a Christmas card. It's a dynamic condition that leads to a really powerful attitude, that it's a change that changes everything. And then I later found out it completely changes brain chemistry and brain structure.
And how does that affect our manifestations? How does it affect our life?
Well, I think it's in simple terms. I think that, you know, like for example with me, that I had an outcome from the surgery that was unexpected, mm-hmm. that was very positive. I think that medicine now would explain that in terms of that attitude, that peace of mind that I carried into the surgery created that mind-body connection that does lend itself to an optimal result. Mm-hmm. And I think, too, that, you know,
that's
somebody
who... That's releases all the resistances, doesn't it, and reactions, yeah.
Exactly. Exactly does that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well said. And yes, and it puts you in what they call a homeostasis, where your body is... Your body's doing well and responding well. I think too, you know, in terms of attraction, that the attitude of a person who's shifted from being stressed and, you know, cracking the whip on people to somebody who's peaceful, who's focused, who's kind, who would you rather work with?
Right, yeah.
So I'll take that guy. And it makes you more attractive, and it attracts good, attracts like people to you, and together you create opportunities that you'll never create when you're fearful.
Yeah, and I think when people around you are not afraid, if you're peaceful, it generates their creativity as well, because they're not afraid to kind of reach inside and unfold, are they?
No, that's really true. I think that's really true.
So you went into...
And you know more about the area of attraction than I do, but I really, the more I've studied neuroscience, the more I can see that this idea, this law of attraction, there's reality to it. There's physics to it.
Hmm. That's great. Well, do you believe that we're... Well, I want to go into... You went into then the Department of Psychiatry, but you're still an executive physician, right?
Right.
When did you start to use this amazing information the way you're doing now, which is rather massive?
Well, when I was younger, I started out in the field of psychology in college. And I worked with a guy named Carl Rogers. He's the father of humanistic psychology, and I think one of the top psychologists of all time.
Mm-hmm.
He really brought healing to the field of psychiatry and psychology. So I was already grounded in that to begin with. And then when I was in the Department of Psychiatry at Stanford, I was around wonderful people who were doing amazing work, and got exposed to it, got really excited by it. And so the next, there was a point in time, about 3 years after my brain surgery, that I just had this very strong premonition that it was time to leave. Stanford. It was time to leave the mainstream and go to work in some place that was working with what had healed me, that shift from fear to peace. And the place I found was the Center for Attitudinal Healing, that was started by Jerry Jampolsky. And they hired me to be their executive director, and it was a really hands-on job. It was not only managing, this is an agency with an international reach, so it was not only managing its affairs, but participating in its programs. And so I would facilitate groups, because I was already skilled at that. I would facilitate groups with people who were facing some of the most stressful stuff any of us ever faced.
You said like a refugee camps.
Yes, we went to the Clinton administration sent us to Croatia and Bosnia to work with refugees there. I worked with lifers at San Quentin Prison.
Hmm.
I've worked with people that, you know, parents who've lost children. You know, it's some of the most stressful situations anybody faces.
Well, Don, I want to jump back into the Bosnia people or the lifers. It's like, how would you explain, were you able to get their brain patterns shifted? Is this the right way to put it? Brain patterns shifted so they could have a life that was self-generating, that was more high-end, more representative of their potential?
Yeah. Yes, definitely.
How does that work?
Well, I wouldn't have been able to describe it in neurological terms. All the breakthroughs have happened in the last 5 to 10 years. But what happened, what those people, the process those people went through was a process of self-discovery, and the self-discovery was the same process I went through. they came to realize that that fear was the problem. Whatever the situation they were facing, that it wasn't the real problem wasn't out there. It was the fear that they were in.
Mm-hmm.
That was where most of the psychological pain that they were experiencing was coming from.
But did you lead classes or did you facilitate that awakening?
Yes. Well, wow. You never facilitated an awakening, but we provided the environment where people could wake up.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be in workshops and, support groups. There are a lot of support groups with people over there, and that's what we did at San Quentin Prison, support groups. And people made this shift from feeling overwhelmed by circumstances to discovering a way of being that made them larger than the circumstances that they were facing. So there were people at San Quentin Prison, for example, people serving a life term, that really began to find that inner dignity that they could bring to themselves, to their life every single day, and overcame a lot of programming that was in them from childhood that said they were no good, that said they were worthless. They made that shift, and they made that shift from being people that made a whole series of mistakes to people that were capable of helping other people. And that's what they ended up doing. They ended up helping other people, other inmates.
Hmm.
And what's happening at the level of the brain is that the brain, when we're stressed, which is most of us,
mm-hmm.
4 in 10 of us are extremely stressed in this country. Another 4 in 10 of us are 1 or 2 serious stressors away from joining that group. When we're stressed, it means we're in some form of fear. And when we're in some form of fear, the primitive brain, it takes control. It takes control of our brain. And the primitive brain operates from a negative emotion. You know, evolution, it's about survival. And you
All
know,
right.
evolution decided that, you know, anger and enmity and spite was going to get you, save you from a bear better than loving kindness.
Right.
And so your emotional meter when you're stressed kicks over to the negative. And you are anxious. You're edgy all the time. And it's because of the way your brain is wired. And you can rewire your brain. It's called neuroplasticity. And you can rewire it in ways in which you're not dumping all those stress hormones into your brain, which are knocking out higher brain function. You can rewire it and light up an area of your brain called the prefrontal cortex that gives you everything you need to succeed at life. And, you know, people will ask me, how do you do that? And the answer is really simple. The way you do that, the way you create the brain chemistry and brain structure to shift control out of fear is by being at peace. The research is really clear about that.
So you mean like if you have PTSD or you've been severely battered as a child or distorted or whatever, you can still do this?
You can still do it. You can still begin to quiet down those emotional memories, those flashbacks. That's what's happening in post-traumatic stress disorder is that you're reliving an event in the past over and over and over again. So the quality of light at 3 o'clock in the afternoon is just the same quality of light on that day that this trauma happened. It'll set you off. Or a person that...
So those are like programs, like computer programs of... something that happened, right?
Right. They're exactly like that. And they're meant, and they're in there, they're in the emotional brain for your survival. So it used to be, the way it developed, it used to be like animals would eat a plant and the plant would be toxic and they get really sick. And then they would eat the plant again. Well, eventually the evolution developed this thing called the emotional brain or the primitive brain. And what happens is they eat a plant, it makes them sick, they remember the smell of that plant, so the next time they come across it, the primitive brain, the emotional memory, is a flashback to that mm-hmm. time you got sick, and you avoid it.
Hmm.
So if you've had a trauma that's happened to you, like war,
mm-hmm.
a trauma,
mm-hmm.
or even a trauma, you know, from early childhood experiences of being with an abusive parent, you come into a situation that begins to look like that old pattern, your primitive brain will flash back to that, and it'll set off a stress reaction. And those stress reactions then can spiral down. They can become very, very painful.
Mm-hmm.
But, yes, you can.
And they can leave you very, very dysfunctional, can't they?
They make you very dysfunctional. Yes, exactly. They paralyze you. Well, you know, when fear takes over, it's immobilizing.
Mm-hmm. And people, you know, don't... I'm thinking of some young people. I'm thinking of somebody who's just 30, and he had a lot of crazy stuff in his childhood, and now he's trying. He's got a wife and a child, and he's trying to get his act together, but he keeps completely coming undone, financially, physically. Now he's drinking too much, you know? And you know that it comes from that childhood. So
right.
Can we use him as a hypothetical case of, like,
sure.
What do you do with him? What do you do with him?
You first of all, you love them. Yeah. That's the first thing you got to do with anybody.
Okay.
Have compassion for the pain that they're in, the dysfunction that they're having, understanding that it's disguising a beautiful nature. We're all born with that beautiful nature. And then you begin to move him into questioning, bringing into awareness his pattern, bringing into awareness the way in which he stresses out. Most of the way in which we stress out begins with fearful thinking.
Mm.
Psychological. But see, here's the part of the problem. Here's the biggest part of the problem is the primitive brain, will set off a stress reaction when there's a real and present danger, to be met.
Right.
So that, you know, you step out on your patio and you see a snake and you boom, you know, you're in a stress reaction.
Right.
Until you figure out what to do with the snake or get to safety. But we also create all kinds of stressful events in our heads that set off these emotions that create this perception of threat.
Mm-hmm.
So that when we open up a bill, like our credit card, and it's more than we thought it was going to be, and it frightens us, that fear goes to the primitive brain, and the primitive brain sets off a stress reaction because it cannot tell the difference between a real and present danger and one we've made up in our heads. You know, it's what Mark Twain meant when he said, "My life has been a series of terrible calamities, some of which actually happened."
I love that.
Yeah, and the funny thing about that is it's so true. You know, that's why everybody laughs at that.
Mm-hmm.
So what I would do if I was coaching this person is to begin to get this person to track their thinking, their fearful thinking. For the next 2 weeks, I'd have them monitor every time they had a stressful, fearful thought, and then to tell themselves that this thought is in me, it's not in reality. And even though it is in me, it's not me. It's a cloud passing across a blue sky. I'm the blue sky. And then I would move them along from there. You do that for 2 weeks, and you come to the awareness that you're generating a lot of fearful, stressful thinking all the time. And it dawns on you, no wonder my life is dysfunctional if I'm thinking in this way. And eventually what ends up happening neurologically is that as you do that, you thicken a neural pathway that leads from the primitive brain up to the higher brain, and it creates a dense fiber called GABA fibers. And when the impulse to become reactive shoots up from there, it slows it down, and you're a choice. And now you can look at this situation, and you'll still feel the energy of wanting to react, but you'll also have that another space open up in which you can logically see that this reaction is inappropriate, and that this reaction has never given you what it is that you want. It's always caused you trouble,
mm-hmm.
And now you're a choice. And then from there, the person can begin to exercise making new and different choices. And that's in Mystic Cool, I lay out a series of tools that represent those choices. A choice to connect instead of separate yourself from people. Choice to forgive instead of blame.
Hmm.
A choice to be quiet inside and engaged peacefully with the situation instead of afraid of it.
Hmm.
And as people do that, as they make this change, and in a relatively short period of time, we're talking anywhere from 8 to 10 weeks, you will see a change. And that change has to do with the brain rewiring. And that rewiring shifting control out of that fear generator in the primitive brain to the higher brain.
Well, does that impact the subconscious as well?
I don't know much about the subconscious.
Okay.
So I couldn't really answer it. But it will certainly give this person greater clarity. There will be more, they'll be operating more from conscious awareness than they were previously. You know, when you're operating from the primitive brain, you're operating from the unconscious.
Well, that's true.
It's the brain using you.
And I guess it's anyway we have a repetitive pattern, so we can assume it's a reactive pattern from the primitive brain, can we?
That's right. You know, exactly. You know, stress and fear just recycles itself over and over. It sees everything is fearful.
Well, let's talk about fear. Do you think that, because my thing is always that fear is being dumped into our psyche from all media, from everywhere. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely.
Yeah, and it's through kind of the fashions of thought, and there's so much murder on television. Have you noticed that?
Oh, yes.
And all the stress hormones that go with that and so on. It's kind of an addiction, isn't it?
It is, yes. Yeah, we are addicted to it, and the news is, instead of calling it the evening news, they should just call it the evening bad news. Because it's all bad news and it frightens people. You know,
Well, maybe what we need to be doing is telling people to really pay attention to the fear that's evoked by that and work with that. Or how would you suggest people do it?
Well, I think that sounds like a very good suggestion. You want to remove, you can also remove,
you could throw your television out.
Yeah, you can be more discreet about the kinds of things you watch on television. You know, we just went through 9/11, mm-hmm. A lot of pain and suffering that it caused people. And there were, you know, when I watched the coverage of it, there was far more coverage on the pessimism that it makes people feel, the attack that it felt like it did to us, and very little exposure to incredible heroism that people displayed and the way in which New York City actually shifted its attitude and people became friendlier to one another. And that doesn't mean you condone what happened to the Trade Center, but it means that you don't allow the circumstance to drag your mind into fear and into the pessimism and despair that fear ultimately turns into. You don't allow that to happen. And if you look around, you can see evidence of something wonderful that's happening inside of human beings. And you can figure out what it is that they're doing, and you can do that. And you can be inspired by that. And you do that, you turn into an inspiration. Then you become the person out there that's inspiring the world.
So how do you get to do that? Do you turn off the TV? Do you watch it and then comment and get people to see what they're perceiving? Like, for example, with 9/11, how many times did they show the buildings coming down? Bam, 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 bam. You saw it 24/7 for quite a long time.
That's right.
And I remember when the Challenger blew up, was it Challenger, February 1 year?
Yes.
How every time you turned on the TV, you saw it blowing up. You blew up, and it blew up, and it blew up, and it blew up.
Yes.
Right? And I think there's something about that and what it does to our primitive brain as well, don't you think?
Yeah, well, it certainly does. I mean, you can get locked into fear. And so if you're watching a program and you begin to feel uncomfortable, you begin to feel that your peace of mind is being effective, my recommendation is to turn it off.
But you know, there's another weird thing is that people get turned on by the chemistry that happens. Have you watched that?
Yep.
Like the horror stuff?
Yep.
How do we convince people that that's pretty dangerous, isn't it? That's where I keep talking about we get enslaved by influences, you know. And in that case, I think that's a real slavery.
You're absolutely right. I mean, we live in a culture that broadcasts a lot of fear, mm-hmm. and we get conditioned by it. We're not immune to it. So you're right. You're absolutely right about that. But we can do something about it. We have a choice about it.
And when you talked about the refugee camp, that's a perfect place to go to understand this, isn't it?
Well, and one of the things that people have to ultimately come to, the people that I work with, people that attend my workshops or that I coach, is that to value peace above all else, to make it your primary goal as you step out your door to enter your day, that your peace of mind, that inner peace is the primary condition that you want to create that day. And we still, you know, we're still pretty programmed to value fear. We think that fear keeps us safe. But, you know, when you look at that, it's an oxymoron.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, how can fear keep you safe? Fear is the absence of safety. So it's a change in what we value. And most of us think of peace as, you know, being a good boy or girl, or something that we hear about at Christmas, or, you know, in the business world, it's thought of as losing your edge, as a complacent way of being. And peace is a very dynamic way of being. You know, in its most basic sense, peace means that you're not afraid.
You're
out of fear. It's the opposite of fear.
And
so that's the one thing that has to happen, is we just got to start valuing peace more.
Yeah, because you've got the research on monks and meditations and so on. What happened to the brain? Do you want to tell people about that?
Well, you know, one of the things that they did is they found out where we generate our attitude. And attitude is the most powerful asset we have as human beings. Attitude's more important than facts. Attitude's actually more important in terms of business success. It's more important. Somebody with a great attitude is more likely to succeed in business than somebody who has a degree from Harvard Business School. Attitude is power. And it's the one thing in our life that we control. It's the only thing that we completely control in our life.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out to be that attitude is enough to control our lives, to make us a good life, a great life, if we want to go that far. And so what they found in the brain about 10 years ago is where our brain generates attitude, and it's in the prefrontal cortex. And they noticed that when somebody was very stressful, very fearful, that the right side of the prefrontal cortex was lit up. And this is not right brain, left brain. It's just the right side of this particular area, this neurocircuitry.
Mm-hmm.
And when the right side was lit up, people were fearful and very stressed. When the left side was lit up, people were content, were peaceful, were engaged, were happy. And they were able to index most of us, all of us, rather.
And that was on an MRI, right?
That was an MRI. So they take people, put them in a tube, and, you know, our brain is very magnetic. And so they use it to check blood flow, and that's where they get these activity readings. And what they found was that we all are a mix of negative and positive emotion that works together to form our attitude. And as I was saying before, you know, Aiden, four of us are over there on the stress side. Four of us are in the borderline, one or two stressors away from being over on the negative side. And only 2 in 10 of us are over there on the left. And when you look at the profile, the personality profile of a person with that attitude type, with that positive, peaceful way of being, it's a person whose life is working. Their relationships are working. They're a good parent. If they're a boss, you know, they're a great boss. They're the kind of person everybody wants to be. If life knocks them off their horse, they're resilient. They get back on the horse really quick. It was a great profile. And so the neuroscientists wanted to know, well, can you coax the brain? Can you help the brain to build neurocircuitry that would push you to the left, to the positive, if you were prone towards the negative, towards the pessimistic side of your attitude? And so they decided what they would do, since the hallmark of the left side, the positive side of that emotional neurocircuit was peace, they decided, well, let's take a look at the brains of people who practice inner peace, which was monks.
Mm-hmm.
And the Dalai Lama sent them 16 monks, and they used a whole bunch of very delicate, wonderful instruments to look into these guys' brains. And what they found completely astounded neuroscience. They didn't know that a brain could develop to that degree. What they found is the most extreme reading to the left prefrontal cortex that they'd ever seen. That meant that these people, emotional negativity didn't stand a chance in these monks' mm-hmm. brains. They were completely positive and at peace. And so they looked deeper, and they found that the central part of the brain that controls how we relate to other people, how we connect and form relationships, was well developed. The right insula and the caudate, these are areas that make us loving, that make us empathic, that make us a great human being, a great parent, a great whatever we want to be. It's the kind of person you want to have a relationship with. But they also found that other areas of the brain, particularly the prefrontal areas of the brain, were more expanded and better integrated, and were producing a lot of gamma wave activity. And what that meant was that these people were peak performers, that they would excel at whatever they did.
And not because they were going faster or working harder, because their beingness was more efficient or more.
Their brain chemistry and their peace, this dynamic state of peace that they practice every day, had built brain structure and produced brain chemistry that created a brain that worked at its absolute best. That's what happened. And so if you want a brain like, so what science basically came back and said is that inner peace creates an amazing brain. If you want an amazing brain, take peace seriously, because it can do that.
So let's jump to Alzheimer's or older people that get these incredible dementias and so on. What is the research on that, and can this understanding be transposed to help that group of people?
Well, it can with dementia, and you can infer some things about Alzheimer's from dementia, although it's Alzheimer's is still such a mystery, it would be hard to say about Alzheimer's, but you can say about dementia. In my book, I isolated the four things that these monks were doing that created this state of this mental state of peace, the practices that they were doing, and that's what Mystikula is. There are these four qualities, and one of them is being peaceful inside regardless of what's happening outside. In other words, the outside doesn't threaten you. If you get a bill and it's got a little bit more money, you don't go into fear.
Okay.
If you see a little spot on your hand that wasn't there yesterday, you don't go into thinking that your life threatened now. You know, you stay calm. And the third quality of Mystikula is connection, your sense of connection, that, you know, you have an open heart in the way you relate to people. You listen better. You judge less, you forgive more, and you create these wonderful relationships. Well, what they found in research they did in Sweden, that people who were relaxed, relatively at peace, seniors, people in their 70s, that they were relaxed, relatively at peace, and they had a strong social network, they were out with family and friends, and they kept those things going, that they were much less, 50% less likely to develop dementia than people who were worrywarts and isolated themselves. And those were two qualities, that being at peace, being peaceful inside regardless of what's happening outside, and connecting with other people through relationships, that these monks were practicing. And so it builds a neurocircuitry within your brain that gives you an immunity to things like stress and like dementia.
Well, and so one of the things that's occurring to me is that it is a practice, isn't it? So, for example, if you're getting dementia, can anything be done to help them reformat the way the brain's handling things even at that point, or do we know that yet?
I don't think we know that yet about dementia, but this we do know, is that the brain is plastic. In other words, it will change its structure according to what you practice. So
it's your intention. It's intention and it's meditation. What is it?
And it's also action. It's also what you do. You know, it has to do with you really work at learning processes and approaches to letting go of fear. You really begin to put your peace of mind above all other things. You really begin to bust that fearful, stressful thinking that sends your body into a stress reaction.
And what about forgiveness? I know you just wrote an article on forgiveness, didn't you?
Yes, you practice forgiveness. Forgiveness creates a powerful brain. And when you think about it, when you're in a state of unforgiveness, you're not very peaceful, are you?
No, you're not. Yeah. It's a tension.
I don't think they go together. And so whatever it is, you know, if you want a great brain that will give you a great life for the full expanse of your lifespan, then the prescription boils down to one word, and that one word is peace. And it is the condition that gives us everything we want. And in the end, it's the experience we want. We want to be at peace with ourselves. We want to be at peace with the world. We want to be at peace with the people we love and care about.
We do, don't we?
And as we are, we grow a great brain.
Now tell me about children, because obviously as you're talking about this, I'm going, how can we teach little ones who have had stress? You know, there's a lot of stress in the world these days. I even think that some of the food additives and so on, keep them in a state of stress. What do you think of that?
I think so, yes.
So what do we do with children?
Sugar rushes aren't good for kids' brains.
No, and I just think about the other stuff, the colors and the Fruit Loops and the hoo-ha, you know.
Yeah.
I think it's breaking up their ability to be peaceful, actually.
I think you're right, too. And, children develop, understanding how their brains develop is important to do. And there, PBS had a TV series that educated people on how a child's brain is developing to a certain stage, what's happening, what you can expect from them, and what's still in development in them. The same thing for teenagers as it goes forward. It's called The Life of the Brain, and it's really worth watching to get you educated. I'm noticing too with young people, my children's generation, people in their 30s, you know, with kids, they are paying much more attention to nutrition. Nutrition's really important in terms of brain health. So is exercise. Exercise is really important to brain health. The most important is attitude. And I think the way in which if you really want to begin to grow a wonderful brain inside your child, then what you need to do is help your child shift from fear to peace. Same rule applies to them. And the way you teach them that is by shifting it yourself. Mm. Because they model you. They will model you. I wrote this article recently, back to school article, and it was the magazine that wanted me to write it, we were thinking I was going to write it to the kids, what you could do, get the kids to do, and I wrote the article of what the parents could do, which was it's a stressful time back to school. It was in my house when I had my four kids.
Mm-hmm.
But to the degree which we can begin to mitigate that stress, quiet it, be peaceful, make homework, chime it in with a Tibetan gong or a prayer bell or something, just to continue create this value around this dynamic state of peace, and to begin to explain to children that it's power, but more than anything else, to model it, to be it, to be the change. To be the change in your brain you want to see in your children's brain.
I like that a lot, you know. So you've got an institute now, haven't you? You're institutionalized.
I have a human performance firm that works with corporations. And we go into corporations that have reached the limit of what they can tolerate in the way of stress, and they want to shift it. And then we help them to shift it.
How do you do that? Do you go into individuals, or do you do seminars, or what do you do?
We start out with a one-day training, mm-hmm. in which we lay out all the principles to everybody, and we give them the practice. It pretty much the one-day training pretty much follows the table of contents in the Mystic Cool book,
mm-hmm.
and so by the end of the day, they've had an experience of this, and they understand the neurobiology of what's happening, of what's possible. And then that usually creates a pretty big shift in people, but it's not sustainable. You know, you can't turn around 40 years of fear conditioning in a one-day workshop. But you can get people's attention, and you can inspire people, and you can begin to give them the tools. And then so we follow up with them. We do a brown bag lunch meeting with them every 2 weeks for 3 months. And we just keep going over it, and we keep encouraging them to practice and not to give in, mm-hmm. and to never give up on the power of peace to change their lives, the power of peace to give them this immunity to stress that they need to succeed. And
are you getting great corporate results? You know,
yeah, we are. Very, very, very satisfying results.
Well, tell me, does it show in their numbers? You know, their profits and all of that.
We really don't have the means of being able to measure that, but they
well,
say
wouldn't
that
it be
they,
great if you could? Wouldn't it be great if you could hang out the numbers and go, okay, corporations, take a look at this.
Yes, it would be wonderful.
You could change the world.
For like you and I, Veronica, it's a no-brainer. It's got to. I mean, if you turn on a brain that is so much of its power has been dampened down by stress hormones, things got to go better.
Yeah,
but
and
no,
also collectively, well, I mean, it's the end of our species if we don't recover from some of this horrible daunting that goes on with
control.
Yeah,
we need that brain power to save the planet. We definitely do. We need more and more and more and more. And the wonderful news is that, you know, Gandhi said that how did he put it? He said the difference between what we do and what we're capable of doing, the difference between what we do and what we're capable of doing would suffice to solve most of the world's problems.
Mm-hmm.
And that is true at a global level, it's true at a personal level. And it has a lot to do with our brains. The difference between what we do with our brains and what our brains are capable of doing would solve most of the problems that in our personal lives, at the level of our happiness, the level of our success, the level of realizing the dreams and that our innate potential keeps dreaming for us, you know, all of that. And that translates to the macro, to the global world as well. And we need it. We need it now. And fortunately, we got people like you showing up all over the place, creating forums for people to begin to reconsider things.
And you're passing on peace right now, which I love very much. It's wonderful.
And through you.
Thank you.
Without you, there would be no passing this on. And so I'm very hopeful, you know, I'm very hopeful because of people like you and the things that you are doing, that together, you know, and with the people who tune in and listen and take this seriously, because it's very serious stuff.
Yeah.
But it's serious about having a great life. That's what.
Well, Don, do you have a great life? I sure hope you do. Do you?
Yes, I do.
Good.
I do. I have a lot of joy in my life. You know, the thing that gives me I love to write. So I'm late in life coming to writing. I always loved it, but I never found the time for it. I was too busy as an executive, and now I'm writing and I'm having some success with it, and I think I rewired my brain for it, and I think it proves, I'm kind of walking proof that if you always wanted to paint or write poetry or create music, it's never too late.
No,
your brain will, you start directing your brain in that area, it'll start doing it.
And
so
one
I get
of
a
the,
lot of joy from that.
And one of the delightful things about you and your book, Mystic Cool, and probably other things that you write, is that you bring together all kinds of other people's research and so on. I feel really good about that I feel like I'm getting a greater picture than just one person.
You.
It's a community approach or, you know, you're sharing
yes.
well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think there's anybody out there doing anything original, but there's a lot of people. You know, we're all standing on the shoulders of wonderful people, and I wanted to be very careful, first of all, in the book to make it simple without oversimplifying. And then secondly, to make the science really simple. So the science is really simple. People can really get it, I think, in that book. And then
you make it vitally human as well.
Oh, well, thank you. I wanted to do that too. And give people tools. Give people a lot of tools. Not ones that I made up, but tools that have been proven by clinical experience. And
well, I keep hearing from listeners that they're really enjoying the book and learning a lot with the tools. And we have to call this we have a few more minutes yet. You've done a wonderful job with the book. And so what else are you writing?
I'm writing articles for magazines. And I have a second book. Actually, I have two books I'm working on. One is a sequel to Mystic Cool, which just makes it very... I want to tell stories of some of these people I'm coaching so that I want to take each one of the tools and tell a story about what the shift actually looked like when it happened for somebody.
Oh, that's great.
And then the second book that I'm working on is called Simple Faith, and it's really the story of that I was telling at the beginning of the show. It just goes into that of the enormous spiritual opening that happened for me. And, you know, the one thing I really do want to say to everybody who is listening is that you don't have to have an epiphany. You don't have to go through, to have your life go through this storm of stress that I went through to have an epiphany.
You don't have to have a brain tumor.
You don't have to have a brain tumor. You don't have to lose your job. You don't have to have a crisis out on your back porch that turns into an epiphany. You can just learn from what I learned, because it's a very simple lesson. I mean, all of that I went through boils down to that, you know, peace is letting go of fear, and that peace is success in life, you know. Peace is what matters, and peace is what gives you everything you want. That's what I learned. And that fear is the stress that we experience, and you don't have to experience that. It's mostly going on inside. It's not coming from the outside.
Well, I also got something from your wonderful epiphany also, that when we allow it, we'll actually feel the love of the universe.
Yes, that's true.
You know, that was pretty poignant in your story.
Yes, that was pretty poignant in that moment. It was wonderful to come out of fear, to be on the other side of that river, and to be in the land where someone loved me that much, and that helped me enormously. And I always remember that.
And you make me feel like we can all have it too.
Absolutely.
So we're going to have to say goodbye right now, but I hope we'll talk again, Dawn. I'm excited about your work and your book, Mystic Cool. One more thing. Why is it called Mystic Cool?
Mystic Cool stands for, the cool part stands for when you get off that hot seat that stress puts you on, that fear puts you on.
Mm-hmm.
And mystic is when you do that, light up your higher brain, and it seems like the dots start connecting themselves. Intuition kicks in. It feels mystical.
So you really get answers when you thought there was a blank, huh?
Exactly. That's a great statement.
Thank you, Dawn Goey. I've really enjoyed our time together. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. Many blessings.